You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. De Tocqueville called democracy a great experiment. And this November, a great experiment in democracy will take place across the country, an experiment in voting. After the 2000 presidential election, many states moved to avoid a Florida fiasco by replacing their traditional paper and pull-lever voting machines with high-tech electronic voting models. By some estimates, as many as 50 million of us will vote this election on a touch screen voting machine for the first time. Maybe you're going to be one of them. There are some studies, though, that have questioned how tamper-proof these machines are, and some experts say that unless the machines provide a voter verifiable paper trail, think of it as a ballot receipt, then officials won't be able to conduct recounts in close or disputed races. Other experts say that electronic voting may not be perfect, but nothing is, and e-voting may not be just more accurate, but also easier for some people who had trouble recording their vote last time. So for the rest of the hour, an electronic voting update. Where do we stand now? Have lessons been learned? And whatever happened to those missing ballots reported lost last week in Florida? Give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Dan Wallach is an assistant professor of computer science at Rice University in Houston. He joins us today by phone from Seattle. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you. David Pogue is the state-of-the-art columnist for the New York Times in New York. He joins us by phone. Welcome back to the program, David.
Thank you so much.
Dan, Florida election practices have been in the news lately. Let's get to those missing records that were suddenly missing and then turned up. Can you fill us in on that?
Well, my understanding is that all of the, when you have electronic voting machines, they generate electronic records. And simply the computer that they copied them to crashed, and they lost all the records, just like that.
And then somebody found a backup copy of them?
I'm not sure about that, but certainly we have plenty of evidence that they weren't taking as good care as they should have.
And would it be normal to make a backup copy?
Well, certainly in any kind of data that you think is important, you have a whole institutional backup scheme.
David, have you been following this? I know in your columns you've taken on this whole electronic voting issue, and from reading all your columns, you're sort of almost throwing up your hands at some point here.
I swear, I think we should all just have a giant show of hands. I'm so thoroughly depressed by this whole thing. There's no way out for this fall, even if we can overcome the baffling resistance to having an audit trail, a voter-verified paper trail. Even if we could overcome that resistance, there's no way to have them in place by this fall. So, in fact, close to a third of Americans will be voting on these machines with no way to conduct a recount, no possibility. It's all stored as a tally on a memory card, and so if somebody wants to do a recount, all they can do is consult the memory card again, and that total will not have changed. So there's a lot we can do with better practices and better routines and rituals. We can go a long way toward fixing the problems that way, but there's a 50% odds, I'd say, that we're going to have a debacle this November that'll make, the 2000 Florida Chads look like a warm-up act.
You think it's 50-50?
At this point, yeah. I mean, I'll ask you, what could we do if, say, Ohio comes down to a tally from computerized voting machines and one side accuses the other of rigging? How could you possibly find out if there was any or not?
Because there's no paper trail.
There's no paper trail, and the public is not allowed to inspect the software.
And the electorate is that angry that we might get challenges on all these votes?
Well, one thing I can tell you from the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of email messages that readers have written to me is that this makes the contentiousness of abortion or gun control or Bush versus Kerry look like child's play. People are really heated up on both sides of the issue. If you talk to certain experts, they'll tell you, you guys, this is ridiculous. There is no totally secure voting system. You can rig lever machines. You can rig paper machines, and it's been done. There is no totally secure system, and by comparison, these systems are much better. You'll hear them say, we have a 0% rate of overvoting. That's when you vote for more than the number of candidates you're allowed to and they throw your ballot out on these computerized systems. 0% rate of that. And also old people and blind people and illiterate people can all use these machines alone in the booth where they have never been able to do that before. So those are very persuasive arguments. And then you talk to the computer science professors like Dr. Wallach, and you say, oh my gosh, what are we doing? These things are, you know, hopelessly insecure. There's all kinds of loopholes. What are we going to do?
Dan Wallach, do you think it's going to be a fiasco this November?
Well, it's hard for me to predict whether we're going to have, you know, the breakdown of society as we know it. But one thing I can say is that no election official can say with a straight face that their system is going to work and that nothing will go wrong. They just don't know. They don't have enough information, and the public doesn't have enough information about how these systems work and how they can be manipulated and how they might fail.
Let's look at what has happened so far in different elections this year. Have you got some examples of where it has worked and some where they haven't worked?
Well, there have been some spectacular examples of things going wrong. One example that a lot of people like to talk about is an election that happened in Broward County, Florida. There was a single issue on the ballot. You'll vote for just one thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, tens of thousands of people showed up to vote. And in the end, the issue was decided by something like 10 or 20 votes, but there were 120 votes recorded as no vote. And it defies imagination to think that 120 people would go to the polls on a single-issue election and not cast a vote. Now, that could be a computer malfunction. It could be a result of tampering. It could be a result of bad user interface design. And we'll never know. There's no way to go back and figure out what actually happened on that day.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to throw in, Ira, that this idea of what has gone wrong and tracing it is a good example of the kind of mass confusion that's going on. For example, we've all heard about the failures in California, right? Mm-hmm. How in San Diego County, 50% of the precincts had these Diebold voting machines did not work, and untold thousands of voters were turned away from the polls, which could not open because the workers could not get the machines working. You've heard that, right?
Yes.
It turns out that isn't what happened. And I've actually been working on a news story for CBS News that's going to air this Sunday morning just about this, and I interviewed just about everyone involved with this issue. And one thing I learned is that in this case in San Diego County, the voting machines worked fine, and the issue was when you go to vote with an electronic voting machine, rather than a paper ballot, you're given a smart card, a little credit card sized card. That has your party affiliation and other information about your district encoded on it. You put this in the machine, and that tells the machine what ballots to bring up for you, which options to bring up. Well, the problem that happened in Florida was not with the machines, but with the smart card encoder.
You mean San Diego?
I'm sorry, San Diego. And it was with these encoders, and what had happened was they had shipped them to the precincts a week in advance in boxes that weren't supposed to be opened until the morning of the election, and the batteries died. The batteries were all dead the morning that they were opened. So that would have been no problem. You'd just plug them in, except these things were rigged to boot up into Windows CE, or WINCE, as we call it for short, rather than the voting and coding software. So if they had known, all the workers would have had to do was go to the start menu and fire up the voting and coding software, but they didn't know how to do that because it had never happened. So what I'm saying is that this is all a lot of this is about procedures, protocol, training, and getting used to this very different technology.
It
was something as simple as that, but thousands of people couldn't vote as a result.
Yeah, and if something like that happens. So that's when I mentioned this is really a national experiment that's going to happen this November. I really wasn't speaking too much out of the side of my mouth on that.
Yeah, to some extent, that's entirely true. Our nation has previously voted on much simpler technologies, whether mechanical lever machines or marking with a pencil or pen on a paper ballot.
Right.
And when you have something as simple as marking on paper with pen, then there's a whole lot less to go wrong. Everybody can see it, they can touch it, they can understand how the process works. And even if you use computers to count the ballots, you can still recount them by hand if things go wrong. And in fact, there's a technology called precinct-based optical scanning where you actually put the computer right on top of the ballot box. When you use a system like that, if the voter overvotes, then it's caught. And in fact, it kicks it back out. It says, I'm sorry, you can't cast this ballot. So there are ways that technology can improve the paper voting experience, but still preserve something that poll workers understand, that voters understand, and, oh, by the way, it's a whole lot cheaper.
Why can't we make a universal system that, every machine is exactly alike, and if one breaks down, you plug another one in, or everybody's been trained, you could be on the other side of the country and had to fix someone else's machine.
Well, that's one of a number of things that are sort of broken about the American voting process. It turns out that every state, and I believe every county, buys its own gear and makes its own buying decisions. I've heard from a number of voting machine companies very upset about all this because their machines have always had voter-verified paper trails. And by the way, just to be clear, this paper trail thing is not a receipt that the voter takes home mm-hmm. and could lose. That's not what we're talking about here. It's you cast your vote, and then you see under glass an ATM receipt sort of thing that lists what you voted for. And then on the screen, you say either, yes, this is what I wanted, or no, it's not what I wanted. I want to vote again. And that rolls away into a roll out of the glass area so that it could be recounted in an emergency. But only the state of Nevada will have this audit trail by this fall. I believe that by 2006, this paper trail issue will be moot because everybody's going to have them by 2006, but not this fall.
So you're saying we've got to grind our teeth on this election.
Yeah.
But between now and November, it's just too late to talk about ripping out old technology and putting in something new because the vendors don't have it ready for sale yet, and we've already heard about policy and procedure issues. The poll workers and the voters need to get comfortable with the technology. You don't want to put in something new right before an important election like this November. So between now and November, actually the Leadership Council on Civil Rights published a detailed report that has extensive recommendations for how to improve policies and procedures, and it also calls for things like inviting independent auditors, people like myself, to come in and study the security and see how well-designed these systems are, whereas right now everything is completely kept under wraps. We don't have a chance to study any of these systems.
Well, if we can't rip out the machines that are going to be installed now and are going to be used, is there something that we can, any surveillance or watching or something we can do, David, that or both of you, that might help to mitigate the situation?
Well, I'm a big fan of some of the steps that are being taken now. First of all, if you can believe it, when people buy these voting machines, when states buy these voting machines, a number of them did not insist on being given a copy of the software, the source code, as it's called, to inspect on their own. Some have. Maryland did that. They would not pay Diebold unless they got a copy of the software, and they ran it by their own experts. But California did not, and that's one of the reasons the Secretary of State of California, Kevin Shelley, recently decertified all of California's electronic voting machines until the state was given the source code to inspect and some other systems were put in place. And by the way, the majority of those have now been reinstated. But this fall, California voters will be given the option. They can vote either on the touch screens or on paper. But I've already forgotten the question.
The question was, what can we do to make sure that we get the best?
Oh, right, right. So another thing that Maryland does, and I think every state should do, is random spot checks. That is, drop by the polling place, pick a machine at random, take it into a side room, and do some testing on it in parallel. And the beauty of this is, no matter how rampant your conspiracy theory about these machines being rigged to throw every fifth vote to one candidate or another, and believe me, the websites on the internet about this electronic voting thing are out of control, the conspiracy theories. I mean, some of them just strain the credulity. But anyway, if you take them, do spot checks, I find it very difficult to believe that if this software was rigged nationwide to throw an election to one candidate or another by Diebold or by whoever did the rigging, I find it difficult to believe that would not uncover it.
Talking about the electronic voting that's coming up this fall on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, David Pogue, state-of-the-art columnist for The New York Times, and Dr. Dan Wallach, assistant professor of computer science at Rice University in Texas. Our guest, 1-800-989-8255. Let's take a phone call or two. Ann in Walnut Creek, California. Hi, Ann.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Well, I think you guys are being much too casual. This isn't funny. And I don't know whether any of you has a teenage son or, draft-age son, but I mean, this is really crucial. Now, it may, of course, there's always been fraud, but that doesn't mean that this is not a crisis. So it's my understanding that when the vote, first of all, if we had a paper ballot, all that would tell us is what the machine is saying right now our vote is received as. It doesn't mean that it's saying how, you know, what happens beyond that point. And then, of course, when the votes are fed into the sort of central tabulating computer, that's a hackable moment. I feel somewhat encouraged by some of the different ways to go in the future, but unfortunately, this is going to be such a close election, and the stakes are so incredibly high that no wonder, you know, these emails are being received. And frankly, I think that one should respect and pay attention to each and every one of them, and thank God that there are enough people left in this country who know enough and who care enough to send the email.
Dan Wallach, comment?
Well, certainly you raise an interesting point, which is that the central election computers are also something that could be manipulated. And in fact, accusations to that effect, according to an article in LA City Beat, you know, led to the resignation of the Riverside County clerk, Michelle Townsend. She, you know, there was a period where everybody left the room, and then suddenly the vote totals were different. Mm-hmm. And was it legitimate? Was it not? Nobody knows. And that's exactly the sort of thing that you want to be able to avoid. So I wouldn't say that paper ballots solve all the problems, but what paper ballots do is that no matter how the computer messes up, assuming the voter saw each piece of paper as it was produced, then you can go back and recount those pieces of paper. And that gives you some checks and balances against fraud throughout the computerized system. It means you no longer require the computers to be perfect, and that really improves your confidence in the election's outcome.
Although let's all remember that this is the system that we had in Florida in 2000. You can't possibly be saying that that went smoothly.
Oh, no. So I'm not going to defend punch cards.
Well, isn't that what you mean by paper?
No, so when I say paper, the sort of paper that I like is either where you mark with a pen, so-called optical scan paper ballots, or where the paper is printed by a computer. But it's still just a piece of paper that can be read by any person.
I said, and you'd mark the ballot, and then you'd have it scanned. You'd have a paper and an electronic copy of it. Interesting.
I'd just like to add, that is a great idea. There are a lot of great ideas, but none of them are going to happen. I mean, let's face it, especially for this fall. I mean, this would require people. I mean, Congress voted $3.9 billion for the states to buy these machines, and they're not going to throw out that money.
All right. We're going to come back. We've got lots more time to talk about this issue. It seems like people are interested in it, huh? We'll take a little bit of a break, come back, stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the electronic voting technology with my guest, Dr. Dan Wallach, Assistant Professor of Computer Science at Rice University in Houston, David Pogue, state-of-the-art columnist for the New York Times in New York, and also sort of a weekend reporter on CBS This Morning on Sunday. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, is our number. Let's go to the phones, because as you can imagine, our phones are heating up too, David. So Caroline in Cleveland, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. Well, I'm calling from the Diebold state, and actually the question I had has sort of been answered. I was concerned about the possibility of rigged votes on either side through all kinds of electronic anomalies. But that actually was sort of answered, and I wanted to say something about the punch card ballot system, which is what I have used in living in various states throughout the country in the last several years, and I find it very efficient and mechanically simple. And I'm wondering if this butterfly ballot was sort of badly designed, but it was very clever how it managed to discredit all paper ballot designs and open the way to spending a lot of money on computer voting. The other thing about the paper ballot is that so many of these poll workers, when you go to the polls, they're these octogenarians, you know, elderly people working the polls. And how are they going to learn these complex and constantly changing computerized systems? And I know that the paper ballot, as you said, it can be recounted. And the vote can continue even if there were a nationwide power outage, as the state of Ohio had last year. You know, so there's a lot of issues where I still, you know, vote for. I still vote for the paper ballot, a simply designed paper ballot such as I've been fortunate to be able to use.
All right. Thanks for calling. Now, Dan, I know you. Before we went to the break, you were describing something like that, where you take a pencil or a pen and you mark a little those little bubble ovals, and then you have it scanned.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be what you would suggest?
Yeah, it's the simplest technology that still that it has everything that the computer scientists want. Whereas you mark with a pen and you fill in the little circle, and it also it's easy for people to use. It can be counted mechanically. It can be counted by hand, and you know, unlike punch cards, a normal voter can hold it in front of their face and easily look at it and figure out whether they got the right person. With punch cards, you push your plunger through the little hole, and then you pull the punch card out, and how do you know which hole corresponds to what candidate? So the human factors aspect of, you know, a hand-marked paper ballot is much better than a punch card.
I'd like to stress, though, that I don't think there's any putting Pandora's ills back into her box here. I think the computerized voting machines are here. They're here to stay. There's going to be more and more of them. There is no going back. And as a matter of fact, when Kevin Shelley banned these machines in California, he was immediately sued by four different parties representing, for example, the blind, the disabled, illiterate people, non-English speakers, millions and millions and millions of people who cannot use those paper fill-in-the-blanks systems, at least without assistance. So the computerized voting machines, to their credit, let you put on headphones and listen to the choices read to you. You can touch a button and enlarge the type size, which is a huge feature for aging voters. You can punch another button and have the language change on the screen. So if you don't happen to speak English, so there are and of course you get the tallies much more quickly. So there's a lot of advantages to them too. If only we could just work them out so that they are trustworthy.
And I will agree with that. I say, you know, in a previous job, I actually worked on screen reading software for blind people. So certainly computers can make for a better experience, but it doesn't matter how friendly or how helpful the computer is if its results can be easily manipulated. If we can't make them secure and if we can't trust them, then they're no good.
That's right.
What I'll argue, we should be asking the question, should we add computers to paper? We shouldn't be asking the question, should we add paper to computers?
Right. Your solution is the best. He's proposing the touchscreen aspect of the voting process that would have all the advantages I just mentioned, but then the stability and recountability of a paper printout. And I even like the idea that the touchscreen part that prints out your ballot and the optical reader that reads it could be made by two different companies, could be supervised by different, you know, bodies. So you would know there would be no conspiracy that could rig the entire thing.
And you should be able to read the software or examine the software.
That would be nice.
That's running it. Is it proprietary software that's running it now?
Currently,
yes.
All of the voting machines that are being used in the U.S., the software is not available for any kind of public inspection. And that's something that we find completely unacceptable. Software, the only thing that should be secret in the election is the votes themselves. Everything else should be open to scrutiny.
Mm-hmm. What's Dan? When you say a machine, or when a state certifies a machine, what does that mean?
That's actually a long and tedious process. The vendors typically go to one of a handful of companies, which will say that they'll certify that their machine meets minimal federal standards. The Federal Election Commission publishes voluntary standards that the states generally adopt and then add their own things onto. So, like the state of Texas will say, your machine must first meet the federal standards, and then you have to do these 10 other things. And that's typical for most states. After that, but the federal standards don't say much about security. They don't say much about, you know, reliability against certain kinds of threat models. They don't talk about security the way that a security professional would. And as a result, the machines are built to these minimal standards rather than being built to be robust against the kinds of threats that we think an election will face.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Mike in Bend, Oregon. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. Hey, here in Oregon, we use a procedure which is mail-out ballots. We receive in probably 2 to 3 weeks ahead of the scheduled election time. We also receive a voter pamphlet that each individual organization pays X fee for a pro and con version of their side of the story. And I'm curious as to why that may not have been an option that has been thought out at all. You know, it gives my wife and I plenty of time to sit back on our couch, read through everything. We're not necessarily pressured as we go into a ballot situation, you know, close the screen off, and all of a sudden feel like we could be rushed and everything.
There are some states that do give you some extra time, aren't there, Dan and Dave?
But he's saying you get mailed the ballot. You fill out and complete it at home and
That's correct.
It back.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to go to the polling place.
Correct.
And I think the answer to your question is that the underlying story behind everything we've said today is people and politics. It is all, I mean, the money involved is just astronomical. The politics that are involved, like, for example, Dr. Wallach was talking about how these independent third party testing organizations test these things. Well, the one side says, yes, but they are not independent. They are funded by Diebold and the voting machine companies. So I'm like, funded? Well, that's a horrible conflict of interest. Let me look into that. And what it turns out is that they pay for each test. The voting machine companies pay the independent companies for the testing. So is it a conflict of interest? Otherwise, where will the money come from? And I was talking earlier about these alternative voting machine companies, lesser known, that have paper trails, that have the kind of system Dr. Wallach is talking about. But why aren't they in use? Well, it's because they don't know the right people. They're not pulling the right strings in the government. There's also a bizarre Republican versus Democrat overtone to all of this debate. In large part, the people who are complaining about the voting machines tend to be Democrats, and the people in Congress who are trying to quash the security bills, there are two, for example, that insist, two bills that say there must be a paper trail and there must be random spot checking, and they're going nowhere. They're going nowhere in Congress. They're not even having hearings because the heads of their committees, who happen to be Republicans, are trying to squash them. And I've heard it argued that that's backwards, by the way. It's the Democrats whose constituents are often, you know, blind people, illiterate people, older people, who ought to be favoring the voting machines because it makes it easier for those constituents to vote. But anyway, it's all about people and politics and money.
Hmm. So back to the caller's original question, why not mail-in votes? One of the significant threats that occurs in real elections is that sometimes we're not, you know, not all voters are just want to cast their vote. Some voters might want to sell their vote. You give me $10 and I'll vote for your candidate. Or some voters might be coerced. You know, if you don't vote for my candidate, I'm going to fire you. And when you have mail-in ballots, now that enables voter coercion and bribery. And maybe in Oregon that isn't as big a problem, but if you did that in several other states, you could easily imagine that bribery and coercion would become very significant problems.
I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about electronic voting this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with David Pogue and Dan Wallach, our number 1-800-989-8255. Liz in, is it Bonneterre, Montana?
Bonneterre, Missouri.
Missouri, I'm sorry.
I love Science Friday, and thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you,
ma'am. I was
an
election judge for over 35 years in Illinois, and I worked with paper ballots, I worked with the punch card, and I worked with optical scanners. And I want to put in a plus for optical scanners. They leave you the paper ballot that people can mark. If power goes out, you drop them in a ballot box anyway, and they can be counted. The ballot can be rejected right then if they have overvoted, and the person can correct it, unlike punch cards, which you only find out later as an election judge and have to throw them out. But one time when I was working as a judge, a person actually tried to stuff the ballot box with two or three ballots, and the optical scanner kicked that out, and we caught him. And so I'm very impressed with that method, and I think it would be a good one for people to use.
Are they using that where you vote now?
No. They use it in McDonough County in Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gentlemen, Dan Wallach, that was something that you were suggesting.
Yep, that's exactly what I'm suggesting. It's a technology that's available in something between a third and a half of Americans are going to vote on that sort of technology this November. So it's already out there, and it's already well understood. It's the best thing we've got today.
Liz, are you fearful for this election season coming up?
Am I?
Yes.
Well, yes, I am. I would be, mm-hmm. because I do think that we're not totally prepared all across the country, and we're not consistent all across the country. And
Yeah.
So that bothers me.
Well, thank you for calling.
Okay, thank you.
Take care. 1-800-989-8255. David, we only got a couple of minutes left. Any positive words about
Well,
are you just still very quiet? I don't want to put words in your mouth. Obviously very fearful, and I can tell from our listeners' call that they're very fearful also about what to expect. Are there any states, let's put it that way, well, while we're sitting home on election night, Dan and Dave, are there any states we should watch out for?
Well, I'd just like to throw in, yes, there is some good news. And one is that all this hysteria and all this controversy has put an immense amount of scrutiny on the process, on how this is working. If you really sit down and try to think, how could a software voting company rig an election, you'll find it would really have to be an extraordinary feat. But if you're really, really worried, vote by absentee ballot this fall.
Mm-hmm. And Dan, what states do you think are vulnerable or just not really ready for this but have their machines in place?
Well, unsurprisingly, the swing states are exactly the places where all the controversy is happening right now. Ohio, Florida, these states are having intense debates inside them about the amount of scrutiny that should be applied. Earlier, I mentioned the League Leadership Council on Civil Rights recommendations. Florida just completely rejected those recommendations and said, no, everything here is just fine.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? Like, no matter which side of the argument you're on, who could argue with more control and more scrutiny?
I completely agree.
I got 10 seconds left, David. Is it true? I read in your article that there was some talk about bringing the ballot box home with some of the judges, taking them home.
Yeah, I heard from a voting official in Texas who talked about how they used to bring these stacks of ballots and leave them in their car overnight the night before the election.
Okay. That's a fitting place to stop. I want to thank both of you for taking time to talk with us. David Pogue, state-of-the-art columnist for the New York Times in New York. Dr. Dan Wallach, assistant professor of computer science at Rice University in Houston. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Our program is produced by Annette Heist, Charles Berquist, and senior producer Karen Verghoff. Charles is also our director. Our interns are Erica Altman and Julie Kalin. And we have to say goodbye to Julie today. She's going to start college later this month at Guilford in North Carolina. Julie, thanks for all of your hard work on Science Friday. We'll know you'll do a great job in college, and just don't do anything that your Uncle Joe wouldn't do. If you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. And don't forget, you can also surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. And leave us mail and information there. And if you missed any of the references we make, go to our website there, and you can also download past editions of Science Friday on your Audible player. Also, you can get Science Friday's Kids Connection, hiatus for the summer, soon to be back online as school starts. But we also have past editions of it there, and you can use Science Friday to teach children using our curriculum from the program. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.